Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. This is Robert Lamb. Joe is away at the moment, but we're going to go ahead and slot in a vault episode for today. This is just helping us deal with some late summer, or at least late summer break disruptions here. But we're going to go ahead and play Creature of the Gear. This originally published on 9/2/2021. It's an interesting look at gears and when did humans invent gears, and also what do we find that are like gears in nature, and we'll even look at a few wheel-based mythological creatures. Now, don't fret. We're going to be back on Thursday. We should be back on Thursday with a fun interview episode, and then we'll be back into the regular schedule right after that. So without further ado, let's dive right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
Today we're going to be, in a way, we're continuing on past discussions concerning the wheel. Also past discussions concerning like rolling creatures. But we're going to be getting more specifically into the realm of the gear in this episode. Now, I have to say, anytime we get into one of these discussions, I'm always reminded of a few lines from 1971's The Omega Man, in part because it's in its own way, it's a weirdly interesting film. Also, I probably listened to a bit too much White Zombie back in high school. Because there's some, or maybe it's a Rob Zombie song that that samples this movie. But there's this one wonderful line from Anthony Zerbe's character. It says, "The creature of the wheel, the lord of the infernal engines."
What is he talking about? The vampires, or is he talking about Charlton Heston?
He's talking about old Chuck Heston. There, he's the
really
this man represents the wheel and the technology of the wheel and all the terrible things that were done with it.
But wait, I recall the vampires using wheeled vehicles. Do they not? Don't they have like a sort of zombie mobile?
Yeah, I'm not saying it makes sense. I'm not saying okay. It's a fair criticism. I'm just saying that Anthony Zerbe had a really cool voice. And when he said these lines, I was like, yeah, that sounds cool. Don't know what it means exactly, but it sounds pretty cool.
You know, it would be a really good movie monster bug fight, and both are Charlton Heston movies, if you pit the vampires from The Omega Man versus the Atom Bomb cult from the second Planet of the Apes movie. You know, they're pretty similar, I think. Pretty similar morbid humanoids, but I would like to see them duke it out. And Charlton Heston, I guess, can just watch this time.
Yeah, what was that? Beneath the Planet of the Apes? I always liked that one. As far as any eight movies that came after Planet of the Apes, that one always appealed to me. I'm not sure why.
I remember there's a part where they sing a hymn to the atom bomb. You remember that?
Yep, they have just a big old atom bomb in there that they worship.
I think it's like a minor key version of All Things Bright and Beautiful.
But it's interesting. All these things are connected because we're dealing with a human technology and the idea of worshiping the technology, being bound to the technology, and the wheel, and by virtue of the wheel, gears and machines being this thing that is particular to human beings, something that we have created, that's a part of our various civilizations. And I think it's interesting to think about humans as creatures of the wheel, in part because, of course, there have been plenty of cultures and civilizations where the wheel, at least in terms of vehicles, has played no practical role. Perhaps it, you know, you had the wheel as a toy. Perhaps it was used as a spiritual aid or device that could serve as a metaphor. But then certainly by the time we get to the, you know, the age of roads and engines, humanity very visibly becomes a people of the wheel. But then, as we'll discuss in this episode a little bit, you also get into this domain of wheels and gears, of wheels doing things that they don't have anything directly to do with vehicles, but it's all about using the energy of the wheel to do other things. And yet, at the same time, and this also makes me think of the field of biomimetics. Biomimetics, of course, is when we say, okay, I have an engineering problem. I need to turn to the realm of nature for a possible solution, because I've only been working on this engineering problem for, you know, X amount of time. But evolution has been working around similar engineering problems just for millions of years. So perhaps we can cheat off of nature in that regard. But of course, one of the problems is that the wheel almost never comes up in nature itself. Gears almost never come up in nature. So biomimetically, you're not going to turn to nature and say, oh, well, there's a solution involving the wheel that I might use. Oh, let's look and see how this particular creature uses rotary blades to fly, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, I actually really enjoy thinking about this in terms of comparing animal bodies to different types of machines, machine components, simple machines, you know, the stuff you learn about in those first physics lessons when you're a kid. So, you know, the lever and the inclined plane and the pulley and the screw and all that. And I feel like when you do this exercise, there is one type of simple machine that absolutely dominates the landscape of biology, and that is the lever. Biology is full of levers. I think you could make an argument that almost all of the skeletal muscle in our bodies is designed by evolution for the operation of levers. Maybe there are some exceptions that aren't occurring to me, but I would say if not all of them, almost all of them. So, for example, when you use your bicep to do an arm curl, you're curling a dumbbell. You know, the muscle, primarily the bicep, I think also somewhat the muscle in your forearm, is exerting the effort. The load is what's in your hand. It's your fist. And the fulcrum is the elbow joint. And of course, the bone is the lever. So I think most of the body's gross motor activity is based on the action of levers with joints as the fulcrum. But then when you start looking for other simple machines in animal bodies, you can turn up some examples, but it suddenly gets a lot more difficult to scope things out. Like, you could maybe make the argument that sharp teeth and fangs are a type of wedge, which is technically a form of the simple machine known as the inclined plane.
Okay.
But then there are other types of machines and machine parts that are pretty rare or even non-existent in nature. And the wheel is a good one of these. There are really only a few examples that people can point to of things that might be considered freely rotating wheels and axles in biology. Sometimes people bring up versions of bacterial flagella as something that sort of operates like a wheel, sort of kind of spinning like a propeller to move the bacterium. through a liquid medium. And then there are also, I think, some possible parts of animal digestive systems that may function kind of like a wheel. But animal body plans clearly favor the versatility of legs based on levers instead of wheels. And you could make a few different arguments about like why evolution overwhelmingly goes that route. You could say maybe it has something to do with just morphological precedence, like that levers are easier to evolve from the pre-existing forms that were available for animal bodies to work on when in, you know, adapting through small mutations. But you could also argue that there are natural terrain negotiation advantages to levers. You know, if you're not in a world of clean paved surfaces, wheels can actually pretty easily get hung up on things, and you need the articulation of levers and limbs in order to say, you know, get over rugged terrain or to flip yourself back over if you fall on your back.
I think it's also telling that when we look to the world of mythological creatures and beings, we don't see a lot of wheels, or at least we don't see a lot of wheels that are innately organic. And then if we do, we tend not to see a creature or a being that is supposed to be of this world. And perhaps there's some exception to this rule that I'm overlooking, but I thought I might bring up a couple of examples. One, and I know I've mentioned this critter on the show before, there is a demon by the name of Buer, I believe it is, B-U-E-R, described in Johann Weyer's 1563 grimoire, Pseudomonarchia Demonium. This it covers a number of different supposed demons, and this demon Buer is the great president of hell, kind of a goblin faced lion with kind of a wheel of five legs going around it, which I find reminiscent of the pedrail wheel, which I mentioned in a previous artifact episode, an experimental tank wheel that had legs on it. So as the wheel turns, the legs are placed down onto the ground. In this case, they are goat legs. And I've read that they're supposed to symbolize the demon's ability to move in any direction. So I'm not entirely sure that we're even supposed to imagine this creature turning like a wheel or like a clock or something. But when I look at him, that's all I can see. Like, he basically moves on the page or on the screen when I stare at him. And I can imagine him kind of lumping along, you know?
Well, I tend to think about when wheels are imagined in the imagery of mythology and religion, it's often to say something about the fact that the vision is boggling the mind. It, you know, that it's transcending familiar forms and just completely awing you and humbling you with confusion. So I think, for example, about Ezekiel's vision of the wheels in the Hebrew Bible, and how the wheels there, it seems to me, at least, I mean, I'm, you know, no professional exegete on that, but it seems like that they symbolize something about a concept that sort of like surpasses human understanding. You're looking at something that your mind can't even fit around.
Yeah, I mean, we can easily imagine the various connotations that are being drawn in there when you have a wheel like appearing in the sky, because you have the idea of technology, something created by rational beings. You have the idea of sort of cosmic wheels and circular forms related to the movements of the stars and the planets and so forth. And then the idea, too, that if this is mixed with some sort of biological or faintly biological or hybrid form, that is, again, something that is not reflected in nature. It is something, there is something inherently unnatural about this hybrid being that is not even just part animal and part human, or part this animal and part that animal, but part flesh being and part cosmic or technological entity.
Now, then again, in nature and biology, you do find all kinds of round mechanisms and round bodies and even rolling forms. You know, lots of animals can roll up into a round shape and then roll their whole body. What really seems to be unusual in nature, and again, maybe you can only find a few examples here and there that would seem to fit this, is a freely rotating wheel that somehow transfers energy within a broader context. So like the wheel and axle on a car that moves the car body, the car, you know, the chassis is stationary and then the wheel turns to propel it forward. That's what you really don't find much of in nature. But if you're content with just like something round that rolls, you can have a wheel spider rolling down a dune. You can have bugs that roll up into round shapes and roll all over the place. Even some mammals do that.
Yeah, there are some examples of creatures that form rolling shapes. Granted, if the topography is correct, there's also, of course, the example of goat poop I've seen brought up. Granted, goat poop is not itself alive, but it is the product of a biological organism. And the idea here is that the goat poop is nice and round so that it can roll away and hide itself in these kind of environments. But
I advocate for goat poop personhood.
Okay. but of course, one of the things about any of these rolling creatures is, of course, if it's going to roll, everything's going to roll. There's not going to be a stationary part of the rolling creature, as in the same way that, say, there would be the cart portion of an ox cart would remain the same. But when we look to some of our supernatural models, we do see things that work like this, of course, in a very supernatural form. There's a wonderful wheel creature in Japanese traditions. There's a yokai known as Wanyudo, the fire wheel. And he's a pretty famous yokai. You've probably seen images of him, especially if you partake of various like anime products, because he pops up in a lot of things. I think he pops up in some video games as well. He looks like a grumpy giant human head, sort of haloed by a burning, smoking ghost wheel. And we get the impression that the wheel is moving and the head is remaining stationary. He's said to guard the gates of hell. And I've also read that in life, he's said to have been a cruel ruler who burned people on the wheel. So this is kind of his punishment. He haunts the roads at night. He may drag souls back to hell. And there's also a female variation called Katawag Uruma.
Okay, so this would seem to be more like that mechanism you don't really find in nature if the head stays stationary while the wheel turns around it.
Right. And of course, in this too, we have just it's not even pretending to be an entirely organic creature. It is this supernatural combination of two or three different things. But yeah, this is a pretty popular figure. The Power Rangers have even fought him on occasion. Shows up in various anime titles. And I have to say, sometimes he looks a little bit like Dr. Robotnik from the Sonic games.
Oh.
So I wonder if Dr. Robotnik was at all inspired by this yokai. You know, a grumpy-faced man-machine with kind of a spherical design. Because Dr. Robotnik he's the Eggman, you know, so he's often in some kind of little circular pod.
Why do I want to say that the Dr. Robotnik was supposed to be based on the appearance of Theodore Roosevelt? Do you know what I'm talking about?
He does look like Theodore Roosevelt, yeah. So that might be it instead. I don't know. I briefly looked around. I couldn't find anything that connected Dr. Robotnik. There's not a lot of scholarship on Dr. Robotnik, it seems, unless I'm missing it. And if I am missing it, please send it to me. I want to read your thesis.
Okay, our new podcast is An Oral History of Dr. Robotnik.
Now, there's another
throw some I Am the Walrus and some Teddy Roosevelt into a blender, and then there you go.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely a Beatles connection there as well.
Yeah.
Now, I was reading about this particular yokai, and there's one more little story I ran across that I have to share. This was, I found this on Matthew Myers, yokai.com has a profile of Wanyudo and shares a brief story that I haven't found anywhere else, but it's too good not to share, and I'm probably just missing accounts of it elsewhere. But quoting this website, one famous story from Kyoto tells of a woman who peeked out her window at Wanyudo as he passed through town. The demon snarled at her, saying, "Instead of looking at me, have a look at your own child." She looked back at her baby, who was screaming on the floor in a pool of blood. Both of its legs had been completely torn from its body. When she looked back out at Wanyudo, that child's legs were in its mouth, being eaten by the mad grinning monster.
What? So did he teleport the... Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. He's eating those baby legs. He's a bad dude.
That's a bad dude.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AstaproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a six-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last two decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So anyway, I'll stop there with my wheel creatures. But suffice to say, just bringing these up to drive home the fact that I think we have long not expected to find wheels and gears in the natural world. They are things of our creation. We are the people of the wheel.
Well, especially the gear. So that was my original idea for the episode, was to focus on the idea of artificial gears versus possible examples of gears in nature. And while you can make arguments for a few examples of wheels in nature, the gear is really a different kind of story, except for this one really cool example that we're going to be looking at today. So what is a gear? Well, you've seen gears before, but to actually define the concept, what counts as a gear? I think you could say a gear is a set of rotating machine parts with interlocking teeth. So these can often take the form of a kind of flat circular plate, but they can also take the form of, say, like a long shaft that has teeth on the shaft, or they can even be non-circular. There are more kind of square-shaped gears and gears of all different kinds of shapes and sizes. But what's common to all of them is that they have teeth that interlock with each other, and they use those teeth and rotation to transfer force, rotational force known as torque. So they can transfer torque from one place to another, and they can also sometimes transform that force in some way as it is transferred. So gears can change the direction of rotational force. Like if you picture two interlocking wheel-shaped gears, you rotate one of them clockwise, it'll actually rotate the other one counterclockwise. So that'll perform one kind of change. Or you can change the orientation of the torque by having the gears interlock at an angle. So think of, for example, how if you imagine a car that has the engine sending its rotational force, its torque, through a drive shaft that runs along the length of the car, then that energy has to be transferred to the wheels to get them rotating in the direction that's parallel to the car's motion. So there are gears that interlock at angles there to transfer that force eventually to the wheels. But gears can also be used to gain mechanical advantage or change the speed of a rotational force in a mathematically predictable way. So, for example, if you use a bigger gear with more teeth to spin a smaller gear with fewer teeth, the smaller gear will spin faster than the larger one, and the change in speed will be proportional to the ratio of the tooth counts between the two differently sized gears. In other words, if you use a gear to drive a second gear with half as many teeth as the first gear, it will spin exactly twice as fast.
To a certain extent, it almost feels like wheel wizardry, because the wheel is doing its thing. And if you're not going to do anything else, you can do various tasks and carry out various acts by interacting with that wheel on its terms. But by the use of gears, you can transform it. You can make the gear work in other ways. And I think that's one of the fascinating things here when we're talking about sort of that leap from wheel to gear. And of course, and this could be just as simple as, well, I don't want horizontal rotation. I want vertical rotation, that sort of thing.
Right. But it can also, this last thing I mentioned about the predictable mathematical relationships between the intervals of rotation of toothed gears, the fact that toothed gears are quantized, right, that you can like put a number to the number of teeth on a rotation that allows you to tightly control the ratios, you know, how fast one spins in relationship to another one, that actually has made gears useful not just for, say, applying force to things like, you know, powering a machine or something, but also for tasks related to more abstract types of work like measurement, such as measuring intervals of time, and not just in straightforward timekeeping devices like clocks, though of course gears are very important in analog clocks, but even more complex applications like we see in one of the most intriguing artifacts from the ancient world, known as the Antikythera mechanism, which is widely considered the first known computer, not a digital computer, but an analog computer, a computer that uses gears instead of semiconductors for information processing. The Antikythera mechanism was discovered in a Roman-era shipwreck in the Mediterranean around the year 1900, and this shipwreck traced back to a ship that sank probably in the first century CE. Rob, I've got an image for you to look at here that shows the actual remains of the mechanism alongside a modern reconstruction that was sort of reverse-engineered and built by some experts who had studied this machine. The mechanism is now understood to have been an ancient mechanical orrery. an orrery is a working model of the movement of heavenly bodies. And this one would have been powered by a hand crank that operated gears, and this orrery would allow you to calculate the relative positions of heavenly bodies like the moon and the sun as they traveled through the zodiac out to specific future dates. And I think it may also have tracked planetary motion as well, but that's less certain. I think that's a hypothetical mechanism that may have been present but may have been lost.
When I look at it, I'm instantly reminded of those gear devices you find at museums and zoos, where you can squash a penny and make it into a collector's token. Which I have to say, as a parent, I have long realized that children are drawn to these like flies to meat. They have to turn the crank. They have to watch those gears operate. And now that we've actually discussed gears a bit on the show, I've long been very annoyed by it. Like, oh, come on, don't mess with that. We're here to look at something else, and you're just going to turn this gear on this machine that I'm not going to give you 50 cents and a penny for because it's a dumb invention. But at the same time, they're interacting with the gears. They're getting to see the gears in motion and see some of that energy transference that we're talking about.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, it's a beautiful way, actually, I think, to educate kids about mechanical advantage, about like what machines can do, because the kid, they know that they wouldn't have enough strength to smash a penny flat with their hands alone, but with their hands by operating a crank in a machine that has no external power source, it's just the power of their arm, but through the mechanical advantage created by this crank, the lever, the gears, they can smash a penny. That's empowering knowledge. There's a wizardry to that too.
Yeah, behold the power of the gear.
But anyway, back to the Antikythera mechanism. So it was able to predict the future movements of heavenly bodies like the sun and the moon, and also I think predict eclipses. And it managed the different time ratios between these moving objects in the heavens by the use of gear ratios to calculate the intervals of these movements. So in a way, this was a calculator. The different ratios between the number of teeth on the gears were doing math for you. Now, we know in the modern world, gears are useful in all kinds of machines. You find them everywhere. They're in clocks, they're in cars, they're in fluid pumps, they're in mills and factory machines. But you might wonder, okay, well, where did they first appear in the technological space? Because you wouldn't necessarily expect to have found a computer for astronomical phenomena in the first century CE, but here it is, and probably actually it's even older than that. I think it's believed to have been, maybe at least 100 years old at the time it was lost in the shipwreck. So clearly that's taking gear math way, way back. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to find some good sources on the ancient history of gears. I didn't come across anything that was super recent, so there may be discoveries since these sources I turned up, but one that was interesting to me because it was by Derek John DeSala Price, who is a British physicist and historian of science, who was one of the investigators who worked on the Antikythera mechanism. He did a chapter that was in a book put out by the U.S. National Museum Bulletin in 1959 called On the Origin of Clockwork, Perpetual Motion Devices and the Compass. And in a short section on the earliest known examples of gears and geared mechanisms, he writes that the earliest evidence for the knowledge of toothed gears probably it goes back at least as far as the Greek mathematician and inventor Archimedes, who showed clear knowledge of toothed gears. And he lived in the 3rd century BCE. But he also cites artifacts from ancient China that may indicate knowledge of gears even farther back than that. He writes, quote, "In China, actual examples of wheels and molds for wheels dating back from the 4th century BC have been preserved." One of the interesting things he mentions about some of these earliest examples of gears in the archaeological record, he says, quote, "A remarkable feature in these early gears is the use of ratchet-shaped teeth, sometimes even twisted helically, so that the gears resemble worms intermeshing on parallel axles."
Hmm.
But then he also calls attention to the fact that throughout much of history, definitely before the Industrial Revolution, a big use of a lot of a major use for gears in the technological space was in mills, in windmills and water mills, using large gears as a way of transferring force, often at a right angle to how these natural forces like the flow of water or the flow of wind were moving the primary turbine.
Yeah, or likewise to transition from, say, a horizontal paddle wheel into a vertical millstone, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, another paper that you turned up on this comes to us from M.J.T. Lewis, Gearing in the Ancient World, published in Endeavor 17, number 3 from 1993. And I was reading through this one. This was pretty interesting. I'm going to be some slight retreading of what we've already discussed. But basically, according to this paper, we can trace the technology of the gear to ancient Greeks of the 3rd century BCE, which also, according to Fagan et al. In the 70 Great Inventions of the Ancient World, this is also the time and place where we see, at least according to ancient Greek and Latin technical authors, the birth of water-powered milling, mm-hmm. A technology that, of course, would be highly effective. But according to Lewis here, in Alexandria, the Greek kings of Egypt at the time, the Ptolemies, they set up a research center called the Museum. I think we've talked about the Museum in the past, right? Perhaps even in our episode, The Invention of the Museum, about the sort of the original usage of this word.
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah. So basically, various technological innovations were said to have emerged from this sort of lab, this kind of technological think tank and laboratory. And according to such writers as Hero, Vitruvius, and Philo of Byzantium, they all point to the work of Ctesibius, who would have lived 285 through 222 BCE. None of his actual writings survived, but he's said to have written various works on compressed air and hydraulics. And Hero, Vitruvius, and Philo would all go on to write at length on these various machines and devices, various gear arrangements. Other great minds of that age and region, such as Archimedes, would also expand on these ideas as well. Now, Lewis explains that we ultimately don't know where and when the earliest gears pop up in human history. Toothed gears, he writes, already existed in the form of ratchet wheels that were used to hold a windlass against a load, and these might date back to Greek crane innovations from around 515 BCE. He also points out that a bronze example of this has been found from about a century later, and this might have been used for hauling ships up a slipway. After this point, ratchets were widely used on catapults as a way of holding back all that potential firing energy. But he writes, quote, "But the first toothed wheel for transmitting motion may have been a sprocket wheel driving a chain. This is attested by two machines described by Philo. One is a chain of buckets powered by a water wheel. The other is a repeater catapult built in Rhodes by a certain Dionysius of Alexandria, who cannot be precisely identified, but may have well worked before 282 BCE. So the Greeks and the Romans obviously applied the subsequent technology to a number of tasks, but Lewis raises the question, did they invent all of this themselves, or did they borrow or pick up on the ideas of others? And he writes that one possibility would be that they somehow got these ideas from China. In fact, he writes that this would be seemingly the only other alternative. However, one of the limiting factors here is that accounts of the gear in China largely come later, from the 1st century CE. But he writes, quote, "The only earlier examples in China so far recorded," and I do want to stress this was like 1993, mm-hmm. "are a number of very small bronze gears and ratchets found in tombs and dating from around 200 BCE to 50 CE. They include extraordinarily what look like chevron or double helical gear wheels of tiny size. All seem too small and too early to belong, as has been suggested, to windlasses for drawing crossbows, and we have no idea what they were for."
A gear mystery.
Yeah, and I include images of these mysterious gears below. So I haven't had a lot of time to investigate further to see if any additional scholarship has emerged on these little gears and what they might have been used for. And I don't know if ultimately there are stronger arguments that have been put forth regarding their use or possible use in crossbow technology. Mm-hmm. But it's fascinating.
Oh, one of these pictures you attach, I wonder if this is what Derek J. DeSella Price was referring to when talking about ratchet-shaped teeth mm-hmm. that are twisted helically so that they look like worms intermeshing on parallel axles. I can see at least one of the images you include from the Chinese example could be what he's talking about there.
Yeah, that's where my mind went when you read that bit, having looked at these examples. Yeah, it has kind of a worm-like quality to it. Now, ultimately, Lewis, in his writing, he contends that gearing was either invented independently in China and in the Greek world, or that it was actually transmitted from the West to the East rather than vice versa. But like I say, there may be additional scholarship that we just haven't come across yet regarding this. But it does raise the question, you know, what kind of gears would one be entombed with? You know, what... Mm-hmm. What bit of technology would it make sense to go to the grave with? I mean, certainly a very nice crossbow seems like the sort of thing you might bring with you. I don't know if it would make sense for there to be some sort of like purely novelty gear device, like something that was more of a curio that maybe wasn't fully utilized or an analog computer. Yeah. Could be.
I guess if your journey in the afterlife really depends on knowing when an eclipse is coming. Yeah, I wonder.
Yeah. And then, of course, just interlocking gears and turning things are interesting. They make us think about motion and interlocking energy. So I don't know. It seems like there are a few different directions it could go in that I could imagine somebody saying, that is something I want to be buried with.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024. And we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
you know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I want to come back to the concept of gears in biology, because for a long time, while there was probably no known example of a working gear in the biological world, there have been observations before of animals having appendages that certainly look like toothed gears. And my favorite instance I came across here is a creature called the wheel bug, or Aralus cristatus. This is a type of predatory assassin bug that preys on all kinds of insects, including aphids, caterpillars, beetles, and bees. I found some very gnarly looking images of caterpillar mutilation.
Yeah, I don't think I'd really seen this species before, or these creatures before. But yeah, they're quite cool looking. It kind of looks like it has some sort of a gear emerging from its back. Also, it reminds me of a buzzsaw, or perhaps to some degree of something like a stegosaurus or a Dimetrodon or something.
Yeah, so it's called the wheel bug, but I think maybe a better name would be the gear bug, because it really does look like it's got this toothed gear poking up out of the back of its carapace, right sort of behind where the head is, up on the thorax. And so I was reading about this insect on the University of Florida Department of Entomology's website. They've got a good profile on it there. And they say in adulthood, this insect tends to measure about 1 to 1.25 inches long. And then, quote, "This assassin bug is a dark, robust creature with long legs and antennae, a stout beak, large eyes on a slim head, and a prominent thoracic semicircular crest that resembles a cogwheel or a chicken's comb. This is the only insect species in the United States with such a crest. The number of teeth or tubercles in the crest varies from 8 to 12. Now, immediately, you're probably wondering, as I was, what does it do? What does the gear on its back do? I could not find any solid research alluding to a purpose of this cogwheel crest. There may be something out there that I couldn't come across, or it may just be unknown. I think it's more likely unknown at this point what this gear crest is for. In which case, barring other knowledge, I guess you might assume that its purpose might have something to do with appearance rather than any mechanical function. Maybe it plays a visual role in interactions with predators or prey or mates, or maybe it's defensive somehow. It's hard to tell. But apparently another interesting fact is that the wheel is absent in juveniles. So if you look at nymphs of this assassin bug, they don't have it. It only appears in adults after the insect's final molting. So once it reaches its ultimate form, then it's got the gear. But whatever it's for, it does not appear to be a functional gear. It just looks like one. I mean, for one thing, it can't rotate, and there's nothing really that it could clearly be rotating against, locking its teeth with. It's just a crest that kind of looks like a gear, or like a chicken's comb. Now, as amazing as these insects look, one thing I should probably note is that you don't want to try to handle it, because apparently wheel bugs can produce an extremely painful bite that that lingers for days. But anyway, this animal is worth looking up. There are actually a few other interesting things about them. For one thing, they do appear to practice some amount of sexual cannibalism. Also, there is another mystery about them. where they produce a vocalization. I think they create a chirping sound by a certain type of a friction mechanism where they rub one part of their body on another. I think maybe they're rubbing some either their beak or forelegs. I think it was the beak on a part on the underside of their carapace, and it creates this chirping, and scientists, as far as I could tell, don't know what this is for yet. But coming back to the idea of an actual mechanically functional gear in biology, as of a study published in the year 2013 in the journal Science, there actually is at least one known animal that does contain working toothed gears within its body. And as far as I could tell, this is also still the only animal that has this feature that's known. And this animal is a type of plant hopper insect known as Issus coleoptratus. The paper that reported the discovery of this animal gear was, like I said, published in Science in 2013 by authors Malcolm Burrows and Gregory Sutton, who both at the time worked in the biological sciences at Cambridge University. And it was called Interacting Gears, Synchronized Propulsive Leg Movements in a Jumping Insect. Now, Rob, I've got some images that you can look at here while I'm talking about this. There's some really interesting electron micrographs of these gear pieces. They truly don't really look animal, right? You know, they do look like a machine. And I always love that when you like zoom way in on the parts of an insect or something, and you get that H.R. Giger space where you can't tell if what you're looking at is natural or artificial.
Yeah, because there's one image here of I believe a nymph of this species, and you know, it's cute, but it doesn't really look like anything other than some sort of a fly or insect. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when you start looking at these electron microscope images, yeah, then it takes on this biomechanical kind of reality, and it's quite unlike anything else I've seen.
So what is this animal, the Issus coleoptratus? Well, this is an insect that is again known as a plant hopper. I think you'll normally find them crawling around on bits of ivy in Europe and North Africa. And so they're very, very small. They're usually just about 3 millimeters long at maturity. And so they'll go around grazing on ivy leaves. And the discovery that's announced in this report is that the juveniles of this species, so not the adults, but the nymphs, the juveniles, they have these interlocking gear teeth on their back legs, which allow them to rotate their legs in perfect synchronization when they are setting up a jump. So these tiny insects have their main defense against predators, and it's not clear exactly what predator this is most adapted against. So I don't know if this would be, you know, against the possibility of being eaten by a large mammal that's grazing on foliage, or being pounced on by a parasitic wasp or some other kind of smaller insect predator or spider or something. That's not quite known for sure, but it is probably some kind of survival defensive adaptation that this creature needs to be able to jump far and jump fast. And they are one of the most amazing jumpers in all of nature. I was watching an interview with one of the authors of the study, Malcolm Burrows, in which he talks about the jumping mechanism. And so the Issus insect will take off at a jump of about 5 meters per second, or more than 8 miles per hour, which for a tiny insect like this is pretty fast. It accelerates to its jumping speed in less than a millisecond. And so the way Burrows explained this is that this insect experiences absolutely in unfathomable G-forces as it takes off because its acceleration is so fast. He puts it at 500 or even 700 Gs, which if you look at the amount of Gs that humans are able to tolerate, it's like the amount you can tolerate is a factor of how long you are subjected to them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, usually for humans, the acceleration we can tolerate in Gs, the maximum is like a factor of a few tens, you know, but this would be hundreds.
Wow. Yeah, this is impressive.
So this insect has this amazingly fast, amazingly powerful jump that can just catapult. It's like it's shooting itself out of a cannon using the power of its two hind legs. And what was documented in this paper by Burrows and Sutton is that they captured imagery of gear mechanisms on the hind legs interlocking using electron microscopy and high-speed video recording. And again, the purpose that they found is that these interlocking gear teeth are useful for synchronizing the motion of the legs. Now, why would synchronization of the leg movement be so important that it would have its own evolved mechanism, which is, as far as we know, unique in the animal kingdom? Well, apparently it's because coordination of the timing on the two legs is necessary for this incredibly powerful sort of cannon shot jump to be effective. So I was reading about this in one of the press releases about the study. And what the authors here found is that a lack of synchronization between the legs at launch could cause an uncontrolled, what they call yaw rotation. So if you picture an airplane, you know, you've got the different ways that you can change the motion of the airplane. You've got pitch, roll, and yaw. So pitch would be tipping the nose of the airplane up or down. Roll would be rolling the airplane, you know, raising the wings relative to each other. And then yaw is twisting side to side. If you can imagine an insect that's sort of catapulting itself in this spectacular jump with pushing off with the two hind legs at the same time, if one leg pushes off faster than the other one, you can imagine that it's going to send the insect sort of twisting out of control in its path, which obviously interferes with landing where it's trying to land. Mm-hmm. Now, one question would be, why the need for a mechanical gear for synchronization? Why does this need to be on the insect's exoskeleton? Why wouldn't the insect just synchronize the action of its legs through the nervous system like pretty much any other animal would, right? Like, if you are jumping, you are able to synchronize the motion of your legs through neural mechanisms with your brain and your nervous system, sort of trying to control them through normal motor function and then getting feedback from the feelings of your legs, from like your proprioception and stuff and tactile sensations to try to time the jump together and correct for any imbalances in real time. Well, apparently the insect can't do that because the problem is its jump is too fast to synchronize through the nervous system. The acceleration leading into the jump happens so quickly that the nervous system cannot do real-time feedback to coordinate it. So it needs this mechanical lock on the legs themselves to make sure synchronization is happening because the insect's nervous system can't talk to itself fast enough to make sure that the jump is on target. In their press release, author Malcolm Burrows summarized it like this, quote, "The precise synchronization would be impossible to achieve through a nervous system as neural impulses would take far too long for the extraordinarily tight coordination required. By developing mechanical gears, the ischus can just send nerve signals to its muscles to produce roughly the same amount of force. Then, if one leg starts to propel the jump, the gears will interlock, creating absolute synchronicity. In ischus, the skeleton is used to solve a complex problem that the brain and nervous system can't. This emphasizes the importance of considering the properties of the skeleton in how movement is produced." And this was really interesting to me because it also comes back to, you could maybe even consider this a case of supplementing the cognitive abilities of the nervous system, a sort of embodied cognition, allowing the body to do math for you that your brain and nervous system can't handle.
Yeah, because essentially it's a physical way of solving a problem that is beyond cognitive ability.
Yeah.
And really, when we're talking about the G-forces pulled here, I mean, like, this is beyond space flight. So when we talk about, like, humans have not evolved to travel in space or to deal with certain speeds or physical realities, like, this is a case here where, I mean, this creature is essentially engaging in those kinds of speeds, those kinds of rapid accelerations. So it's fascinating to think about here.
Yeah, the body moves too fast for the nervous system to make sense of, so it just offloads that computation that the motor parts of the nervous system might do naturally, offloads that onto the skeleton. Now, yeah, the exoskeleton of the insect is doing the math for you, kind of like an analog computer would, like the Antikythera mechanism.
Wow.
So to take a slightly closer look at these teeth, at the gears on the hind legs, they're located on the backs of the strong hind legs that the Issus insect uses to jump. They're on the parts of the legs known as the trochantera. And so actually a human skeleton has trochantera too. They're sort of on the upper part of the femur near where the femur would connect to the pelvis. And these insects tend to have somewhere between 10 to 12 teeth on their gears. But while it seems to vary between the insect always has the same amount of teeth on each side within itself. Each tooth is about 80 micrometers wide, so 80 millionths of a meter. And there are some interesting engineered features of these gear teeth within the body that have been created by the evolutionary process that gives rise to them here. The teeth have rounded corners at the point of contact, and this is useful apparently because it would help prevent the gears from being sheared off or broken off if there is a slight misalignment during a jump. Mm. And then another interesting thing about them is that they are differently shaped than most gears we use in the technological world, because usually gears made by humans tend to have symmetrical teeth, right? You know, they're just sort of curved straight out from the gear strip surface. But in these, the teeth are not quite symmetrical. They're sort of angled out, and it's because this gear only needs to work one way. Mm. So, like, after the launch is done, the gear teeth can just separate from each other, and they don't need to roll backwards in the direction opposite from which they came. It's a one-way gear.
Yeah, and you definitely get that from looking at the image. It feels like some sort of a biomechanical, firing mechanism.
Right, a firing mechanism is a good way to compare it, because again, it doesn't go both ways and it doesn't need to roll all the way around. It's just sort of a strip of interlocking teeth that doesn't complete a full circle, and it only rolls one way, only on launch.
Yeah, like it kind of looks like if H.R. Giger designed a flintlock pistol, you
yeah,
know, or maybe if David Cronenberg did, you know?
Yeah. Oh, but so there was a really interesting thing about this research, the question of how did they figure out that these gear teeth locked for synchronization while launching the jump, right? Like how did mm-hmm. they observe that? Well, apparently the authors here used a dead insect. They used an Issus insect corpse. And what they did was they took the dead insect's legs and rotated them back into the jump launching position. And then the researchers used an electrical stimulus to cause a contraction in the jumping muscle of only one of the legs. Okay, so they stimulate only one leg as if it has been told by the brain to jump. But because the gear teeth were locked when the legs were in jump readying position, the insect's legs both performed the launching motion, even the dead leg on the other side that had not been electrically stimulated, and the insect leapt straight forward. So you could stimulate only one of the two legs, kind of like how an airplane can fly with only one engine, you know. Right. You only need to stimulate one of the legs, and the gears keep both legs locked in sync. Now, there's another interesting question here. Why only the juveniles? I think I already mentioned that the adult Issus insects don't have these interlocking gear teeth. They've got a feature that's more common, more like what you'd see in a lot of other jumping insects, which is not gear teeth, but just sort of bumps or friction pads. So their back legs might touch each other. And the touching there helps keep the jump synchronized, but they don't actually have interlocking teeth. It's more just kind of like pushing two surfaces together that grip each other pretty well. In another study by Burroughs, he noted that this is achieved by, quote, mechanical actions between small protrusions from each trochantera, which fluoresce bright blue under specific wavelengths of ultraviolet light and which touch at the midline when the legs are cocked before a jump. So the adults are touching parts of their back legs together to help synchronize a jump, but they don't have gear teeth. And the hypothesized explanation for the difference here is that Issus insects go through periods of molting as they grow, right? So an insect, as it gets bigger and bigger, it will shed its old hard exoskeleton, and then it will grow bigger and allow a new exoskeleton to harden. But the adult exoskeleton at full maturity, it lacks these interlocking gear teeth. And the idea is maybe the adults don't have the teeth because if the teeth on the jumping mechanism were to break or get sheared off by error, this would sort of break their ability to jump. And so once the adult is in full molted form and it's not going to shed its exoskeleton again, it needs to have a less fragile mechanism. But the younger ones, the juveniles, because they will go through multiple moltings and can grow new gear teeth if their old gear teeth break, they pay less of a price for having this somewhat fragile mechanism.
Okay. So here we see sort of in their early stages, the advantages of having an exoskeleton, and then in later life, the disadvantages of having an exoskeleton in that you're not going to get another one.
Right. And so when you're not going to get another one, it makes more sense for evolution to supply you with more durable mechanisms that, that aren't going to possibly like kill you if they break.
Right. There would be a survival advantage in having a jumping mechanism that's not going to, it's not going to be like Boba Fett's jetpack firing off at a weird angle and sending you into the Sarlacc.
Right. But that's just a hypothesized explanation for the difference between the juveniles and adults. Ultimately, we don't know for sure there. And as far as I can tell, this is still the only known toothed gear in the animal kingdom. There may have been something since then that I wasn't able to track down, but it looks like this is still the only one.
Yeah, well, this is fascinating. Yeah, it kind of brings me back to the biomimetics question earlier, you know, evolution solving particular engineering problems over time. And this is an example where the engineering problem is extreme enough that and the circumstances of its lifespan enable this sort of answer to evolve and take place. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you imagine if you had gear teeth on your inner thighs that helped you jump? Seems uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd have to have an exoskeleton, too, for this to take place. Or, yeah, I'd have to have some other kind of weird arrangement. Like, it would have to be bone spurs or teeth that grow back, I guess. Because that would, again, you'd have to have the situation of what do you do about the wear and tear of this, the physical mechanics here.
I mean, it doesn't really make sense for our bodies because that wouldn't be how we jump anyway. Our legs would need to work differently for that to make sense.
Yeah, yeah. So again, we come down to a very specific evolved answer to a specific problem that you're just not going to see in other organisms.
But I am still enamored of the idea that in a way, these gear teeth on the insect's legs are a kind of computer. They're doing a kind of mathematical processing for the animal. This is the computer of the thighs.
Yeah, and also it's interesting too that no matter how much humanity clung to the wheel and to gears and saw this as their technological achievement, here we have an example of evolution once more beating humanity to the punch.
Yeah.
So well before the Greeks of Alexandria were devising their gear complexities, this creature already had the gears right there in its thighs.
These gears are hopping.
Yeah. Well, this was fun. I enjoyed talking about everything from we had a little bit of an invention episode in here. We had some biology. We had a little bit of mythology and folklore. So it would be interesting to come back to this. I know we talked about potentially covering screws and screws in nature in this episode, but perhaps that would make for its own future episode.
Oh, yeah. There are actually a few things in nature that you could argue are screws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then and of course, the invention of the screw and so forth is also quite interesting. All right, we're going to go ahead and close it up then, but we'd love to hear from everyone out there. Certainly reach out to us, get in touch with us. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, core episodes published in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Sandwiched between them, we have an artifact episode, or for the months of September and October anyway, it's going to be the Monster Fact. We're going to take on more of a monstrous form for the holidays here, and then it will likely revert back to the artifact. We have listener mail on Mondays. We have a little Weird House Cinema on Friday. That's our time just to discuss a weird film, and then we have a rerun over the weekend.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.